I forgot to tell you, the fucking June releases for Criterion got announced, like, yesterday.
I was going to, I thought you were going to say, like, June was released.
I fucking wish, that'd be amazing, like, Lynch, and just all these special features of David Lynch, but, like, this is why I disowned this film.
Yeah.
But, yeah, your fucking, What You Want on Criterion got announced on Criterion.
What?
Fantastic Planet.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah. So that's coming out in 2-3 months' time.
That's nutty to me, man.
On a fucking nuts Blu-ray.
That's awesome.
Yeah, fucking A. And so is Doctor Strangelove.
Oh, sweet.
Like, it's like, holy shit.
What a coincidence, man.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, welcome to the Criterion. I was leaning in right when you burped. Let's try that one again. Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. My name is Chris and I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host Tom.
Hello.
And Colleen is sitting on the couch next to him, as always. And Harvey...
they can't see the wave.
Enunciate. Harvey is wandering around and now sitting on my foot. And we all just finished off watching Joseph von Sternberg's 1934 film, The Scarlet Empress. A film that I was very worried about today.
Why? Just because it's so old?
I've had a long day at work. I made the mistake of going to a gig last night and had a super fucking late night and was just like the last thing I wanted to do.
What gig was that?
I went and saw Koi Child. There were guys that played at Golden Plains Festival we were out over the weekend and... it was their album launch. They got fucking Kevin Parker from Tame Impala. He produced their album for them and, yeah, came out today. So I was off at that, which was a stupid mistake. Like a couple of days after a festival and when you have work at 6:45 in the morning.
It's very keen.
But, so the last thing on my mind today was like going to sit down and watch a 1934 film about Russian politics. Yeah. How fucking wrong was I, though?
I enjoyed it.
It's really racy, and... I mean, the first thing you think when you start watching a film like this is God, it's going to take a while to get through this fucking... This hour-long... What, hour-long?
Hour 40,
long
yeah.
It's going to take 2.5 hours to get through this.
And in particular, like, when it first starts, it's very dry and slow and... You kind of get the sense of like, oh, this is very much a 1930s drama we're going to watch here. But then...
I struggled to understand a lot of what they're saying. And
yeah.
Things seem mumbled and things just happen. And they're just like, this scene, and now this scene, and now this scene.
But, like, you get those odd little nuanced moments kind of very early on that start to pique your interest. And then once the character who eventually becomes... I've forgotten what her name was initially. But once she...
Sophia
actually arrives in Russia and becomes Catherine, holy shit, things start moving and this film becomes gripping.
Like, we should do a synopsis, by the way.
Oh yeah, we've kind of breezed over that.
Sophia is a...
You're looking at me because you didn't watch it.
Tom was on his phone for this film.
I didn't watch a little bit of it. The start of it.
You got the gist.
It kind of threw me... When I jumped back in, I was like, what the fuck is this shit? I'm not doing the synopsis, actually. Fuck that.
It's
incapable.
So, Marlene Dietrich plays Sophia, this young kind of... she's not a commoner, but she's not of royal descent. She's like an aristocratic family in Prussia in the 18th century who gets... her whole life, she's kind of been raised up to be royalty. Like, you know... Being her lot in life is to be married off into a royal family. This happens to her where she becomes engaged to the nephew of the Empress of Russia. So she up and moves over to Russia, and it's about her life living within the palace. And at first, it's like the culture shock, and that's kind of what you expect the film to be. It's like this meek young girl transitioning into this new life and the subservient life as this young princess. But instead, she decides to start, once she understands her lot in life, and now she embraces it and sluts it up, for lack of a better term.
Well, I mean, she's going into it with the sense that she must be a machine that produces baby men,
yes.
Baby boys.
She's there
men.
For the specific need of Russia wanting male heirs of the throne.
But she becomes, political.
Yeah, she basically decides, alright, well, if in particular, it's once she starts clashing with the current empress, where it's like she's sort of, using her power and her might to throw Catherine around, order her about and make her a subject and treat her like shit. She's like, alright, I clearly have this power, I'm going to start exploiting and using that in ways that I want, similar to the way that the empress is.
So I think actually the strongest thing in this film is, I would say, the set design.
Okay.
The costume design.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that now, or do you want to talk about characters?
I reckon we should start with characters and then kind of move on to the filmic elements or the production elements, I reckon.
All right.
Because just for me, I initially got hooked in with all the design and things and the look of the film, but what ended up actually really engaging me and keeping me going with it was the character development that Catherine goes through. Especially towards the end of the film, where you see, it's the scene where she's riding the on horseback with the army into siege, pretty much overthrow, and she's leading a coup against her husband to take control of the Russian throne. And she has this proud look on her face, and I just couldn't help but think, back at the beginning of the film, when she first, on horseback, comes into Russia. And she's a slack-jawed yokel who... we were joking that she is Forrest Gump of the 18th century. She's just for the first 20 minutes, half hour of the film, Marlene Dietrich is just what? Where? Who? And then to see her evolve as a character to someone who not only becomes comfortable in her own skin and in her own kind of environment, so much so that she fucking overthrows, and kills her husband. It's
just
crazy.
Yeah, just off a personality cult.
Yeah.
Everyone's driven to her personality and the way she's presenting herself.
Yeah.
It's not ideologies.
It could be this. No.
But this is the weird thing. Do you know much about Catherine the Great?
Not
her
at
brain?
All.
She... I realised that this film presents her up until the point where she becomes empress.
Yep.
So it's the journey to empressdom.
Yep.
Which I thought was... she's not technically Catherine the Great yet.
No.
She becomes Catherine the Great during her reign.
But is that, I guess, is the film taking the license that, understanding, in 1930s, possibly people, might have studied it in school and things, and know, it might be more common history knowledge who Catherine the Great was. And so it's just that sort of thing of this is the prequel to get to Catherine the Great.
It's certainly more dramatic, right?
It ends with, and you all know the rest.
Yeah, but it's, when I was looking up what she had done during her reign, it's not, she sounded pretty great, right? But she wasn't amazingly great.
Well, that's why they didn't call her Catherine the Amazingly Great.
Yeah, okay. But she was just, she kind of just had she just seemed to be good with making the economy boom, and she was giving work to everybody.
She was a just ruler versus the interesting story that is a somewhat commoner rising to the ranks of becoming Empress of Russia.
Well,
a fucking story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's way more interesting than, say, an entrepreneur kicking ass.
Yeah. I know, The Social Network was Empress. Pretty good.
Yeah, okay. That's not the story we're talking about.
No. Just describing the story there about how it's a kind of somewhat commoner rising to power to become the Empress of Russia. That sounds like it is a giant epic film, but it's not really. It's a small kind of personal story, but it is all about her personal growth as a character and her coming to terms with who she is and where she is in life. And I guess then the learning to be comfortable with herself, and then the exploiting of the way that she herself was exploited.
But you
kind
never
of fighting back against that.
Think about establishing shots, right?
Yep.
There's not really... granted, I didn't watch the first half an hour, but which is probably filled with establishing shots.
Not really, no.
But the thing is, I didn't really notice many establishing shots where you're getting a sense of the bigger picture.
No.
It's always seems to be kind of isolated, and you're amongst royalty or nobles or, you know, high military ranks, and you never get a sense of kind of the expanse that is Russia at the time.
No.
So that stops it from being an epic.
Yeah.
That kind of detracts from the epicness of what a Russian coup should be.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether it's maybe it's.
I think that's a very conscious decision on von Sternberg's part. Like in that he's not necessarily telling the story of Russia being overthrown. He's telling the story of this one woman. Yeah. And so because of that, he doesn't need to go into this grand scope of showing this. And like we were discussing initially when we were watching the film that like we couldn't decipher whether or not they were actually on a soundstage or actually out and built sets. Like
you'd have to assume that they're on sets, right?
Yeah, because A, no establishing shots, and it's very claustrophobic and contained, like you were saying. So
It's a weird one because it's a historical drama about a strong woman.
Yeah,
but she's strong and she gets what she wants. And this is a 1938 film.
34
film, where she becomes kind of like a sultry temptress. And
yes.
I thought that it was, and that's how she's getting shit done. And I thought that was such an odd way. I mean, she is that. Well, you couldn't really answer this. Like, is that how she was? She was got shit done by being a sultry temptress.
See, I unfortunately didn't do much. I didn't do any research on Catherine the Great herself. I did a little bit of research on the actual film. The film is adapted from her diaries themselves, or like loosely based on her diaries. Apparently, there has been a lot of historical license taken to tell a good story with this film.
Okay.
So, I wouldn't be surprised if she had extramarital affairs, but I don't think that was necessarily what led her to have backing to overthrow the country. I think it was more the fact that she was married to a legit idiot.
Well, I'm not really. My point is not that so much that, you know, what's factually accurate, more the kind of artistic license taken with filmmakers, because it's an odd. It seems like an odd choice to give Catherine the Great her character. Give Catherine the Great's character such a sexy outlook, what am I trying to say? Like, don't you find
make her a seductress?
Don't you find that it's odd that that her character, when she becomes this this seductress,
yeah,
it really does shift the film into something completely different?
Oh, for sure.
I mean, it felt like less of an epic and more of a kind of kind of sexy drama. I'm trying to think of a sexy drama.
Here's the thing, though. You're looking at it as seduction and temptress and downplaying, you're still making her quite demure. I think what you should be looking at is a woman who was quite innocent and naive to begin with and then learnt from the Empress to use sex as power.
That's kind of what I was trying to get at earlier. It's the idea of the way that she was exploited, she's now learned from that and exploiting the way that she was, like, kind of.
Yeah, and historically accurate or not, then it's still, you know, metaphoric, I guess, that, you know, she got an army.
She
could rule an army.
Conquest out of the army.
Exactly. So the idea is that, like, whether it's true or not, I doubt that it's true. But they're like, yeah, she was, you know, she used sex as power and, you know, she got an army to do what she said.
Yeah.
You know, she got an army to run for her because, you know, she slept with the whole army.
She slept with the whole army, guys.
Yeah. They were her conquests, as the title cards told us.
But it's also very clever. She
so
basically takes what the original Empress did and learned from it.
Oh,
okay.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, Carl.
Can't try and make a point when Tom says prolapse. Sorry, no, but I was intrigued. What were you saying?
I was saying it's interesting that she learnt everything she learnt from the original Empress. Although she used to bed all her guards for her own selfish sake, because she was lonely and a bit pathetic.
That's
true. She realized that she could actually use that. Not only was she like, was she able to do that as Empress,
but she was able to get them on side, and yeah.
Yeah, so she's like, well, I'm going to do that shit too, but I'm also going to have an alternate agenda.
Yes.
And I'm going to use this while enjoying myself.
And it's kind of interesting that the character all of this character development ends up happening almost off screen. Like, we have, it really is like there's a transition of time from when Catherine, you know, there's the dinner scene where she's like, you are my slave now, pretty much. You will serve these men. And then it's just her biding her time. And then the next time you see her, she's dulled, like, she looks fucking fabulous and is just using sex as a weapon, almost.
But it was, I mean, didn't she have sex with some...
It was the first guard, yeah. Well, that was that night.
That was his first day on the job.
Yeah, it was after she decides, like, fuck it, I'm gonna see what I can do with this. Sleeps with that first guard, and then we have the passage of time to next time we see her. Oh my god, she's like almost a dominatrix, like the way that she is.
No,
like,
basic instinct. You go through all the son is born and...
I totally forgot about... Because the film forgets about the kid, and I forgot about the kid.
And there's also the element you've got to look at as well. One of the reasons she started is because she was spurned by, I don't even know what his actual name was. They just call him His Excellency.
Oh, the head guard guy.
Shaw with his
teeth. Yeah, the Robert Shaw, Marlon Brando lookalike guy. Yeah,
yeah, with his teeth white shut.
Yep. But, I don't know.
So that's interesting as well, that's the catalyst for her beginning that journey.
So we have talked about Catherine a little bit. I suppose we've talked about
the Empress is a one-note.
Yeah.
She's a one-note character. She is there for the specific purpose of being a bitch.
She's kind
of showing Catherine what power can be, I guess.
She's only there to kick Catherine into gear.
Yeah, and open her eyes to the world that she's now a part of. Because without the Empress, what does she have? She has the spicy Robert Shaw, Marlon Brando guy, or her idiot man-child husband. Like, there's no one else really around to spur her on and show her what real power can be. So she's one note, but she's a very good one note character. She commands
but I don't think that the performance...
No, that's what I mean. Like, she commands every single scene that she's in, I think. Like,
right.
She...
After a certain point, when she's meant to be the starry-eyed, like...
I'm the Empress, welcome to the palace, and things. After that, once Catherine gets to realise who she is that what you're meaning? Like, after the initial shock of... No?
I don't know. I'm lost. Carry on.
I don't know.
Well, I'm talking about the Duke, the nephew.
Oh yes, her husband, the idiot man child.
He's clearly an imbecile, right? And they always say he's an imbecile.
Yep.
And that he's bad for the country and people hate him. I mean, they show him.
He's rather retired.
I did really like that scene where they're talking about giving to the poor.
Yep.
And it's kind of pretty blatant that they're just like, hey, this guy's a total imbecile and an idiot and you should hate him because he's not giving to the poor like all these other fine
gents. Not just that, he slaps the man and says there are no poor in Russia, which means like his finger is so far off the pulse of what he has done to the country.
Yeah.
That, yeah.
But I thought that was quite strong. But I suppose, actually you just answered my question, because I was going to say, at what point do you get an idea of what he's done to the country?
Oh,
but then you're always
the montage where it's just his proclamation of him destroying his country,
torturing people and
murdering them,
people.
Stealing their money and things because they're harboring gold. He's just like, "Fuck you! Everything that's yours is mine because Russia." And instead of fighting the country's enemies, he's like fighting the country's people, and so that's why the coup ends up happening. I think it's Catherine was able to kind of help get the people on her side through her demeanor and, you know, the sex appeal and everything of that. That, like, her...
Well, she gave them
her exploitation option. That she used...
She gave them what they wanted, too.
Yes.
She says, one of the first times you see her again after the kind of her transformation, it must be Robert Shaw says that to her, something about, you know, I don't like the way you're behaving or something, and she's like, well, now that I know how the Russian people want me to behave... I like it.
Yeah, sucks some more dicks.
Yeah, so she's figured out what they want, and she's like, "Yeah, I'll be that.
Yeah,
I'll be what you want. All right."
And that's also the point of like when that like when she sends him down to open the door and let the man in, he's like, "Tell her, oh no, wait, I get it now. I see what she's doing." Yeah, it's a super fascinating film that, like, yeah, I was expecting this big epic kind of political film, but it is a wonderful little character study.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I really enjoyed it.
Alright,
were there any other character, or I mean, we've talked about characters themselves, but we haven't really actually talked about performance.
I mean it's an American director making a film about a Russian historical figure.
Yep.
And
well, I don't know if Sternberg was American himself. It was an American production.
Okay. Well, they've hired American actors.
Yes.
Except for, you know, a few people here and there. But I kind of didn't like the American... I mean, no one was putting on accents, right?
Yeah.
She had a little bit of an accent. But she
felt different. We're talking about Catherine here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody didn't feel like they fit. Like, their American accents
stood out.
Were... becoming slight barriers.
Really?
Definitely, especially the Empress, man.
I actually found her voice and her demeanor strong enough that she was the one I didn't notice. I didn't really notice her accents.
I agree. Like, the accents didn't bother me as much as I thought they would. If they were fluctuating between American and... some people American, some people British, I think I would have...
was happening. There's the Pleasure Giver. Was British.
Yeah, I suppose.
But I think I prefer that. I'd rather people use their natural accents and just try and do the best performance they can.
Yes, yeah.
Rather than trying to put on a false accent and then spotting it. And that's what I can notice. That's what takes me out of it, is a bad accent.
It's the Tom Cruise Valkyrie theory. Like, everyone else is British and Tom Cruise is like, I'm going to be a German Nazi guy, but like, I'm Tom Cruise, so I'm not even going to try. Like, it's like... yeah, cool. Rock on. I accept this reality.
It's like the Robin Hood.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, no one, like, Christian Slater versus Rickman. Like, it's no. It's
What's the
They did the
Prince
same thing
in
Gladiator.
One?
Yeah.
Mm.
Right.
Gladiator's the same. All these, you could almost say it's a trope at this point.
But then I'm not getting upset by Gladiator, like, in any regard. So it's how you carry yourself. You can get away with it. Like, Catherine the Great in this one, she had a range from, you know, weak, timid little girl to strong, sexy, queen, empress. And at no point was she falling away, and at any point in a sequence, she was the strongest aspect, more or less. In any scene that she was in. But then you got to sequences with the Empress, and she would get frustrated and hit her hand on the table.
Yeah.
And it just felt like she was whining as opposed to cutting through the crowd. And you know how, like, you want to somebody that is demonic.
Yeah.
And like, has a weight to them and an inertia behind what they're saying, but she didn't.
She's in Catherine or she's in the Empress?
The Empress.
I think the Empress did have
I agree
that.
As well. Like,
really?
I'm finding it interesting. Like, yeah, I thought she...
There was some sequences, man.
Every scene that she was in, especially once she had the turn and Catherine realised, oh, this is not the fairy tale I've been promised.
Mm.
That's... I thought she absolutely commanded every single scene that she was in.
I agree.
Like... her stage presence and, like, that actress brought to it was, like, oh, shit, you are controlling not just, like, you know, theoretically every person in the scene, but you are controlling the scene itself.
And the other actors and anyone else in the
room. Yeah, you are in charge right here.
Yeah.
I
Yeah. Man, I want to show you this one.
It almost felt method in that way, that she was in charge.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of interesting. Like,
I kind of want to show you the scene I'm talking about, and I was like, she sucks.
Yeah, I know the scene you're talking about. I think it's when she calls her son in for drilling the hole, and there's a moment where she says something, she has a go at him for something, and it's delivered very flat.
Yeah, it was so bitchy, like whiny, it didn't fit.
But that's the point, she is pathetic.
Yeah. She's not a good person, man.
No,
well,
no,
yeah.
She's pathetic.
And that's her in her smallest moment, like she needs to just be angry over petty things.
That's
so
it. You
gets,
see it
like,
again
no
later.
Bolster to her.
You see it again later when she's dying and the son is finally born and she's all like going manic and she's like, if he has a sniffle, I'm going to kill you. You know, if he has a cough, I'm going to take your head off.
And so his last ditch efforts of power.
Yeah, and she's like, don't anyone fucking touch him unless I say so. And the doctor's like, you know, basically he's like, bitch, calm down. You're pretty sick. You're just going to make yourself more sick.
Yeah, and you'll probably infect this child.
And she just starts wailing and stamping her hands and she sits right up and she's like, I'll fucking outlive all of you. She's like, I'm not going to die. Rawr. And you're just like, you are nuts, lady.
Yeah.
And she's like sleeping with all the guards. It's pathetic.
Oh, Catherine the Great did that.
Yeah, but yeah. They portrayed it differently. Again, they
exactly.
portrayed it like she was using her sex. This woman did it for herself.
Oh, yes.
Well, we're going to have to disagree. I think that she had tantrums that felt like a little girl. And it shouldn't have been like a little girl's tantrum. It felt like her character should have been stronger and sharper. But anyway.
She was. She was running the country.
Hmm. I know that.
But the point, yeah, I see where you're coming from, but I think the ultimate message of like what they were trying to do was like, yes, she is this all powerful person, but in her smaller moments she is weak and
pathetic. A petty creature.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm.
I can't argue with that.
And that's like you said, when Catherine realizes this is not the fairy tale.
Yeah.
Aside from the first time she sees her fucking douchebag husband. That's the other moment, is when she realizes that, you know, in a way you kind of go, well, at least the Empress is a strong, powerful woman to look up to. Nope.
You've been sold up the river.
Yeah. You've got no one here that's, like, of any fucking value, and even the one guy you do love is sleeping with the fucking pathetic Empress.
Yeah, he's sleeping with everyone, it
seems.
And
then Catherine's just like, fuck it.
I'm a do me.
yeah, that's it. She's like, I'll play you.
I mean, one final thing on performances. Like, I mean, obviously, the way that we've described the Catherine character, like, is obviously, we're talking about Marlene Dietrich. Like, her performance is fucking superb in this film, I think.
Once she turns, but
that's the thing. To have the impact of that turn, you need the meek innocence at the beginning.
I think the
turn works so well because, like I said, we were given Forrest Gump for 30 minutes. And without Forrest Gump for 30, like, if she was just meek and quiet, I don't think it would have been as impactful the turn.
No, I think she portrayed poorly the young. She was clearly cast because she could do sultry, seductress, like sex and power.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, she was cast because she could do sex and power. She was not cast because she can do naive 16-year-old. Because all she does is gawp.
Yeah.
It's not a performance.
She's sleeping with Sternberg. They were actually lovers and the director.
Well, look, she
this
knows.
Was their sixth film together, actually. Like, yeah, kind of. They were notorious.
Well, she owns it the second half of the film.
Exactly.
The
and it is very clearly the way that the second half of the film is shot. Like, the director fucking loves this woman.
Yeah,
he's shooting the shit out of her.
Even they were like, just cut through the crap to get to this shit.
And you know, they're like cut, clear the set. Just like, you know. But, one final performance. I think Sam Jaffe playing the idiot man-child husband...
We have to talk about him.
...is brilliant. Like, it is a character that, like, when we initially see him, we all burst out laughing. We're like, what the fuck?
So over the top.
So over the top. But then as you get used to it, you realize, oh, this is brilliant. Like, he never plays it for laughs. He plays over the top, but he's never playing it for laughs.
Not really, no. And the other thing is that you never know quite where the extent of the madness lies. It's you can never tell how. Sometimes you think he's actually retarded, and then other times you realize that he can be calculating and clear.
Like when he like his kind of mistress says, like, no, he plans on killing you and marrying me. Like, it's like, oh, no, he's thought about what he's going to do.
Yeah, even when he approaches Catherine when he's got his it's raining and he has to march his guards inside. And he, like, gets them to all pull their guns or their sword on her.
Yeah.
And there's that kind of just, like, there's that really interesting interaction between them.
Hmm.
It's really, like, and that's kind of the first time I go, this guy isn't... He didn't go full retard.
No, he didn't. That's the thing.
I actually don't know where he landed.
There's this subtlety to it where you're just like, you might... This might all be a giant act.
I think the look is kind of... He's just nailed menacing.
Yes.
And it allows you to kind of teeter from imbecile to a menace.
Yeah,
exactly.
And
yeah.
I would say...
It's a teetering. Yeah, yeah.
That's... And that... What makes him scary, that menacing, is because you just don't know what he's capable
of.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can understand why a country would still follow his orders, because at times he can be quite clear.
And especially commanding.
And composed,
and
very commanding in that, but he's batshit crazy.
To be fair, I mean, because you would pity a fool, but you'll fear a kind of a menacing tyrant.
That's it. So he sits somewhere in the middle, because if he was full, like, if he went full retard, the Empress wouldn't really bother.
He wouldn't get that Oscar.
Empress... Sure, no Oscar.
The Empress wouldn't really bother getting a wife. She'd look for Plan B. You'd start looking at cousins and shit like that.
Yeah.
So he's obviously competent enough to rule.
Yeah.
And she says at one point, "Oh, you'll be a great emperor. Just fucking get your shit together." Sort
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah. Stop playing with toys and put your tongue back in your mouth.
So he plays it really well.
Boy.
Hmm. But I think, like, the performances are only kind of heightened by the way the film is shot, and also the fucking design of this film, which is absolute king and owns this film, I think.
Mm.
Like, I do love the quote on the back of the Criterion box where it says, it calls it a self-proclaimed relentless excursion into style. So,
yeah, it is
it
rather
really
relentless.
Is.
Yeah.
How many, like, every scene that started, every time you saw a new dress, were like, wow.
Yeah.
Dang.
And it's all the statues and,
oh my God,
like, all the set design was just absolutely, like, fucking gothic and almost Tim Burton-esque in some sense.
Like Goya, man.
Yeah.
Like, really Goya.
Yeah.
Like, the carved chairs and stuff.
What style is that? Does it have a... Oh, I'm sure it has a name, like, the artistic... Oh,
I don't know.
Do you have any trivia on who fucking did that?
No, unfortunately. This was a film that there was very little trivia about. Because it actually bombed horribly when it came out. It was the sixth film that Joseph von Sternberg and Marlene Dietrich had done. And
people just sick of seeing them?
Well, no, they'd predominantly done very straight, standard, kind of romance-y type pictures. And this one is something fucking else.
Yeah.
And it's very hardcore for 1934 as well. It's depictions of sex and violence, and also the look and the design of it, that audiences were just like, nah, not buying it. And yeah, it kind of tanked and kind of stopped them.
It's a shame, because it looks amazing.
Yeah. But that's the thing, like, everything I read was like, oh, it is now considered something great. It's like appreciated for what it was, but at the time it didn't take, because it is such a drastically different looking film.
Yeah.
Like, it's to think, like, he's playing with light similar to, like, what we saw Carl Theodor Dreyer doing with Passion of Joan of Arc, almost. Like, he's really using that to enhance the story, and his shot composure is fucking brilliant.
Yeah, the contrast of light and dark in this is really, really interesting and noticeable too, which is kind of good.
Mm. kind of good.
Yeah, but I mean, you don't want to be drawn out too much, or you'd be like, wow, like, too dark.
You don't
want
to film noir, like a detective story.
Exactly,
yeah.
But there are moments where you go, man, I love what they're doing with the lighting here. Like, that's interesting.
The only problem, like, and we were talking about this while we were watching it, was the cluttered frame.
Yeah.
How it was almost George Lucas special edition Star Wars style, where it's just like, let's just put some shit in the foreground to block what's happening in the mid-ground.
Can I just see some more rocks?
Yeah. That's all it was. Which makes me think, like, what if he was trying to show, like, we talked about earlier, the confined sets and things, the smaller scale, because it was a
personalised thing.
Yeah. But then still wanting to show excess in that, and by doing that, he's just cluttered his frame.
Yeah. so much clutter.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Pretty clutter.
Let's take some screenshots.
Yeah.
And we'll put them up because we're all thinking about that dinner scene.
Yes, exactly. The one with the skeletons over the soup bowls. And
which I can't remember who made the comment, but that was the first instance where someone was like, this is just fucking messy.
It's just layers upon layers.
But it might not be messy. I think if we look at it, we can go like, yeah, there's heaps going on, but it's kind of ordered somehow.
It's different if there's kind of, if they make a nice tableau, but it was very two-dimensional. Like Chris said, he's using all foreground and middle ground and no background. So there's no depth to what you're looking at. And nothing is laid out in a nice tableau. It's literally, if there's space, he fills it.
I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll take a screenshot of that dinner scene, and then we'll go to like, we'll get like Barry Lyndon, and we'll find a dinner scene.
Very good call. Yeah, I'll do that.
Comparison.
I'll chuck both of those up on Twitter, and yeah, we can see the difference
why one works and the other doesn't.
And also, that'll work well for lighting as well.
Yeah,
I know the exact Barry Lyndon scene.
Good, good. Yeah. Because Barry Lyndon, that's all done like with natural lighting.
Yeah.
And this one's going for the same kind of thing too, although it's, you know, almost...
It's unnatural lighting a lot, but,
yeah,
it's using lighting in a similar kind of effect.
You know how Barry Lyndon, like the kind of, the interesting part about the lighting in it is that it's all natural, but it makes it, the fact that it's natural gives it an unnatural quality,
yes,
like a fantasy quality about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a floating on clouds, diffused light thing. And this one does the same thing. I don't know, that's my thought.
But I think he's able to achieve that in this film by excessive candles. I think that's how he's getting that kind of shimmering, almost floating look. Is because every single fucking scene had like like 50 candles in it.
Yeah.
And that's on top of the brilliant lighting effects they're already doing on top of it also. But no, I think that's a genius idea to get Barry Lyndon and side by side.
But it might just be taste because, you know, some people like the simplistic vision that you get in Barry Lyndon.
I mean,
it's rather complex as well, but...
I think the design of the film, like, in particular, like, the statues, the thrones, like, all of... And the dresses and the outfits, like, all of those elements, I think, would have popped and stood out a lot more if the frame wasn't so cluttered.
And
like, how much more interesting would that dinner scene look if it wasn't crowded by 50 extras all in the background?
And you can see that they're trying... There is so much... The camera is trying to show you these amazing sculptures.
Yeah.
They're really quite central in the scene. But you can't see them clearly because there's no definition to their edge because everything is foreground, lined up right next to each other. It doesn't stand out from anything. And they're trying to show it to you, but then they're just cluttering it up too much. It's too claustrophobic.
Apart from maybe the throne room.
Sorry.
The throne might be the only... Because it is the only... big room we get in the entire fucking movie.
It's the only wide shot.
That's
it's
true.
Essentially the only fucking wide shot.
Yeah.
Even the wedding scene, that chapel.
Oh my god, yeah,
the
chapel.
You can't even see what's going on.
Yeah, it is cramped in there.
So, that was the other scene I was thinking of, not just the dinner scene. The chapel scene was the first time I noticed, and I'm like, too much shit, not enough space.
Yeah, you're right. What a shit movie.
Fuck this film. No, this film is fantastic.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. The only thing I did like about that church scene, though, that and it did seem like there were moments where they were trying to create that kind of tableau, like they were trying to make a painting in a shot. With the church scene, what was interesting, though, is that the landscape went vertical.
Yeah, yeah.
Not horizontal. Which was very interesting.
You had the priest up, yeah, and it was...
Yeah, and everything was kind of, like, cluttered down... like from top to bottom, not side to side sort of thing, and it was like a cascading thing, and it was very like Japanese painting where the landscapes go up, and I thought that was interesting at least.
I'll grab a screenshot of that scene as well and put that one up so people can because this is a bit of a hard film to kind of track down if people haven't seen it, so yeah. But I mean, is there anything else you guys wanted to touch on that we haven't before we kind of move on to trivia and kind of wrap it up? Or...
Oh, I'm not ready for trivia. I really like this. I feel like you could talk about it for ages.
I know, but it's that problem of I don't want to end up recycling and...
Yeah, that's true. Well, we've talked about characters, performance...
Design,
look.
Yeah, alright, well, we'll jump onto a little bit of trivia. Like I said earlier, this is kind of one that was a bit hard to track down shit for. The film was awarded one of the top 10 foreign films by the National Board of Review in 1934. So that was the one award that it won when it first came out. And this is a little bit of an this is a very niche one, but I found it interesting. That this is one of 700 Paramount productions filmed between 1929 and 1949, which was sold to MCA and Universal in 1958 for television distribution, and have been owned and controlled by Universal ever since. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Why did they let Universal take them?
I'm imagining it must have been in a period in kind of the mid to late 50s where Paramount was in a bit of a... Paramount in the 50s and actually all throughout the 60s was in a rut. Like, it kind of was losing, hemorrhaging money and not in a good way. And so I guess this was one of those films where it performed badly when it first came out, that they were just like, oh yeah, fuck it, we'll sell the rights.
Yeah,
let's
stay afloat.
We need capital, so... Yeah, Paramount only kind of turned around in the late 60s, early 70s, like when, what is his name? Amazing autobiography that he wrote, The Kid Stays in the Picture. He was the...
No, come on, that's
fuck,
a big time.
Fuck,
more clues. He was what?
He was a producer, and then he took over as the head of Paramount, and he was, like... Fucking has this amazing autobiography about 60s and 70s cinema called The Kid Stays in the Picture.
That rings a bell, but I actually
don't
know.
Oh my god.
You're gonna have to look it up.
He was an actor. Fuck.
He had a face, kind of a nose and mouth.
Tied
up into some kind of face.
And his autobiography, it's fucking amazing. It's like Robert Evans! Holy shit! Robert Evans, like he became the head of Paramount, and he kind of turned around with Love Story and Rosemary's Baby, and like all of these films kind of put Paramount back on the map. Yeah.
Cool.
If we somehow got up to Robert Evans here from that one piece of trivia I had.
You got so excited, dude.
I know. If you've never seen or read, like, the documentary Kid Stays in the Picture is equally good as the audiobook, because the film is narrated by Robert Evans. He's narrating his own autobiography documentary. Like, it's arrogant as fuck and hilarious. Kid Stays in the Picture. It's also a recommendation.
That's like a... Yeah, fair enough. Like
that
a
whole
tangent rant bit.
Yeah. But yeah. There really wasn't much trivia, unfortunately, and even like a little bit of, like, kind of historical research on the film have kind of dropped throughout the episode anyway, so...
Well, it was shit-panned by all the religious people.
Yes, yeah, the
really?
League of Decency. Yeah, those old fuckers.
The League of Decency.
Yeah.
Sounds so...
sitting around in a bat cave.
Imagine
wanking
each other.
They kind of really went against this film because, I mean, it does have a very frank look at sex and things for the 1930s, and I mean, shit, there's even
very
nudity in there, so...
Yeah.
Man,
yeah.
She is very open about it. It's like,
yeah,
you want to fuck my vagina?
Yeah.
Because
yeah, like
I'm
when she's walking through the barracks perusing what's on offer.
No.
Yeah,
yeah,
and the implication that she fucks the entire army.
Yeah.
Conquests.
As Tom said earlier, prolapse.
Just fell out. What happens when you fuck an army?
No.
But on that note, we'll move on to the actual Criterion Edition itself. The film is still in print as a one-disc DVD that comes with the following special features.
Speaking of prolapse,
the Criterion Edition. It comes with a 20-minute BBC documentary, The World of Joseph von Sternberg, production stills and lobby cards, a von Sternberg tribute by underground filmmaker Jack Smith, as well as the usual kind of booklets and essays that Criterion always do.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
Rad, man.
Yeah.
I didn't watch any of that or read any of those things.
I read the essay.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it was pretty
good.
Well,
you sounded pretty informed. I mean, like, not from me. I read no essays and watched half the film.
Yeah. You were busy doing...
Do I need... Should I have been on this podcast? Probably not.
No, it's all right. But, yeah, if you have any comments or queries, please send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter @CriterionQuest. And I guess have a look on the R Criterion subreddit for Tom's artwork this week. I'm intrigued at what it'll be.
It'll be pictures of
it'll be half
video
finished.
Games, man, because I was trying to
it'll be
sell
half
video games
picture.
On Gumtree.
No.
That definitely sums up
just
this
please draw half a picture.
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, I guess we'll be returning again next week with a triple feature episode. First one of those we've had for a while, where we look at a trilogy of Jacques Tati films dealing with Monsieur Hollette. We're going to do Monsieur Hollette's Holiday, Mon Oncle, and Playtime. Those three kind of films with that character all in one episode if you tune in next week. But for this week's episode, I'm Chris.
We'll be doing it rather, whether they return them or not.
This is true. This is true.
Yeah.
I'd like for them to tune in.
Me too.
I'm inviting them into a world of discussion.
Yeah.
Please come and hang out with us.
We're so desperate for friends.
I'm Thomas. See you later.
For this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Tom.
I'm Cole.
See you next time.